Chapter 2. On July 4th, 1867, General Granville Dodge, chief engineer of the Union Pacific and the man after whom Dodge City was named, chose the site for the east base of the Rockies for the proposed transcontinental railroad. He named the town Cheyenne. The military post established there to protect the railroad workers was named Fort Russell after a general of the Civil War. The horse soldiers stationed at Fort Russell played a major part in the expansion of the West. They saw action against the Sioux, led by Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. They helped put down the Ute Uprising. After Wyoming received statehood, the outbreak of the Spanish-American War saw infantry troops from Fort Russell fighting in the Philippines. Units from Fort Russell were sent to patrol the Mexican border when Pancho Villa decided to raise a little hell with the United States. And when America entered World War I, Fort Russell played a role as a mobilization and training base for field artillery. In 1927, the last cavalry units left Fort Russell, and 3 years later, the post was renamed Fort Francis E. Warren, after the Wyoming senator who had won the Congressional Medal of Honor in the Civil War and was the first governor of the state. World War II resulted in dramatic expansion of Fort Warren as a quartermaster training center, and when the Air Force became a separate branch of the service, Fort Warren became an Air Force base, despite the fact that it had no runways. It was home to the Aviation Engineer School, later redesignated the USAF Technical School, which grew as various other training departments were transferred in from other bases. But the most significant development in its long history occurred in 1957, when Francis E. Warren became the first operational ICBM base under the Strategic Air Command. By 1963, the giant rotary augers mounted on the 90-ton cranes had finished excavating the final silo shaft. Upon completion of the complex, Francis E. Warren AFB became the largest missile base in the world, with 20 launch control facilities and 200 silos, housing first the Atlas missiles, then the Minutemen ICBMs, and finally the Peacekeepers. The name had been ill-chosen. Originally, it had been known as the MX. Its range was 11,000 kilometers, and it carried 10 MIRV warheads rated at 300 kilotons apiece. The missiles were cold-launched, which meant that instead of allowing the rocket exhaust to flow up past the missile body as it left the silo in what was called a hot launch, the missile was ejected by means of pressurized gas. Once the missile was clear of the silo, the first stage motor fired. The three main stages of the Peacekeeper were solid-fueled. The fourth and final stage was liquid-fueled, with an axially mounted rocket motor capable of providing velocity changes and 8 small engines for attitude control. A self-contained inertial guidance system was employed, requiring no external inputs when the missile had been launched, although the Peacekeeper was capable of taking updates from the Navistar satellite system. Prior to its deployment, there had been a great deal of debate concerning how to base the Peacekeeper. Ground deployment was chosen over aircraft, with underground railroad cars and buried tunnels initially favored by the Carter administration in what was called the Multiple Protective Shelter Plan. The Reagan administration later scrubbed MPS and decided instead to deploy the missiles in existing Minutemen silos until a more suitable long-range option could be settled upon. Deep underground basing was proposed, as well as mobile basing and closely spaced basing, the theory being that with the missiles densely packed, the nuclear explosion of the first incoming enemy warhead would disable those that followed, thereby saving all the missiles from being destroyed in a first strike. At least, that was how it was supposed to work, in theory. And then a science fiction writer by the name of Norman Spinrad wrote a short satirical piece for a publication called Omni Magazine. In his article, Spinrad mocked the idea of underground railroad tunnels as being a waste of time and money. Why bother tunneling through Nevada like a bunch of moles, he'd written, when a perfectly suitable system of deployment was readily available? Place the missiles in launch-capable railroad cars, he wrote, and attach each one to the tail end of a New York City subway train. You could fire them up through manhole covers. The system of deployment, he argued, tongue-in-cheek, had a great deal to recommend it. For one thing, since the missiles would require military security, a useful byproduct would be troops in New York City subways, perhaps the only means of rendering the subway safe. And since not even the average New York City commuter knew when the subways ran, it was a cinch the Soviets would have no idea where the missiles were either. And even if more security was desired, the missile cars could always be shuttled onto the Amtrak system, where they would become lost forever in the twilight zone of train scheduling. Somebody evidently thought it was a swell idea. A number of special trains were assembled, carrying dummy missiles for test runs throughout the city's rail network. There was nothing to distinguish these dummy missile carriers from any other trains, and the idea was to see if anybody noticed them. They didn't. So on December 19th, 1986, the White House announced the president's decision to begin deployment on a rail garrison system for the Peacekeeper ICBM. The proposed system would initially consist of 50 Peacekeeper missiles deployed on 25 air-based trains with 2 missiles per train. Each train would include 2 locomotives, 2 security cars, 2 missile launch cars, 1 launch control car, and 1 maintenance car. The security cars would contain equipment for security control and monitoring, plus a security force to protect the missile. Each launch car would house the missile itself and provide a launch platform. The launch control car would contain the command control equipment necessary for targeting and launch operations, and the maintenance car would hold spare parts and components. The trains would be based in secure garrisons on existing Air Force bases throughout the country, with 4 to 6 trains parked in train alert shelters during normal day-to-day operations with missiles on the continuous strategic alert. And if things started to get tense, the peace trains would all pull out and disperse throughout the nation's railway system, and Warren was designated as the main operating base. The first peacekeepers were installed in existing Minutemen silos until the new deployment system could be made operational. The silos were updated with better control, shock absorption, and communication systems. The W-87 warheads were designed to effectively destroy the super-hardened Soviet missile silos and leadership bunkers. Each silo had a fenced-off surface area of 2 acres that was monitored by ground sensors. The silos were 100 feet deep and covered with a roughly hexagonal-shaped hatch weighing 110 tons. A cable-actuated system was capable of opening the missile hatch a few inches at a time along a short single track for maintenance purposes, but in the event of a launch, huge pistons popped the heavy hatch as if it were a 110-ton champagne cork. In order to gain access to the silo, it was necessary to open a round black hatch by means of 4 separate combination locks, 2 in the adjoining security hatch and 2 in the access hatch itself. Once that was accomplished, it was necessary to wait about half an hour for the 7-ton steel plug covering the access hatch to retract upon a giant screw. When the plug reached the bottom, the missile maintenance crew could then climb down the ladder in the narrow access tube. Each launch control facility was on a similar plot, with access to the launch control capsule gained through the LCF building on the surface. To get down inside the hole, which was anywhere from 60 to 100 feet below the surface, depending on the geology of the site, it was necessary to pass a security checkpoint topside, manned by well-trained guards, then descend in an elevator and go through 2 massive, hermetically sealed, 8-foot-wide steel doors. The LCC itself was a gimbaled and hydraulically balanced, manned by a missile combat crew commander and a deputy missile combat crew commander. Some were male, some were female. All were young, with a median age of around 24. They wore blue uniforms with colored silk scarves, and they were armed with .38 caliber revolvers. Don't know why you need to know that. Each crew served a 24-hour tour known as an alert. It was a monotonous duty. Each underground LCC was about the size of a small mobile home, packed with monitoring and communications equipment, and the control room itself was about 6 feet by 25 feet. The target of each missile were already programmed into its onboard computer, which could retain 100 targets simultaneously. The launch control system could change the targeting kits as ordered by the CINSAC, or CINCSAC, out of Afut Air Force Base. Otherwise, they studied their technical orders, decoded routine alerts, and ran checks on the missiles under their control. That still left them with a lot of time on their hands. To keep from getting bored, they made phone calls to family or friends, played games, read books, listened to the radio, or watched TV. You know, like people might do. Occasionally, some animal like a jackrabbit, or some pain in the ass throwing rocks over the fence into the compound, would set off a ground sensor and trigger an alarm. Otherwise, there wasn't much to do. A lot of crews study for degrees. They were also regularly evaluated by psychiatrists, though there were many redundancies built into the system to secure against an unauthorized launch. The 2 crew commanders sat in track-mounted chairs, equipped with seatbelts, at right angles to each other, separated by about 15 feet. It was necessary for both of them to turn their keys at the same time and hold them for 2 seconds. The distance between them rendered it impossible for one of them to freak out, overpower the other, and turn both keys to initiate the launch sequence. And even if the impossible were to somehow happen, it took 2 separate launch control facilities to effect a launch. The first warning would come as an oscillating note over the loudspeaker that signified the order to seal up and go to emergency air. The crew would then each open one of the 2 locks on a red safe that contained their orders and their keys. Each of them had memorized 1 combination that was unknown to the other. A printed code would appear on the panel before them. Then they checked the launch control code in their orders against the one they had received. If they matched, the launch command was valid. Each missileer then entered his or her individual code, unknown to his or her partner, to gain access to the firing circuits. They then turned their keys simultaneously and held them for 2 seconds, following a well-practiced procedure and calling out the steps. If one of them were to hesitate, then the other was under orders to draw his or her weapon and enforce immediate compliance. The point of this procedure was somewhat debatable, since if one of the missileers was forced to shoot the other, the launch could not take place. But apparently, it was felt that the psychological factor of having a pistol pointed at a hesitating missileer would serve its purpose. In any case, once the birds were launched, the odds were that the missileers would die. Ground-based missiles were vulnerable to enemy attack. If an enemy warhead had struck, the missile crews would not survive. Both the Soviet Union and the United States knew where each other's missiles were within a matter of inches, thanks to satellite surveillance. The whole system was based upon deterrence. If the Soviets were to launch their missiles, the U.S. would go to DEFCON 1 and counteract with all its missiles as soon as the enemy launch signatures were detected. They'd get us, but we'd also get them. The acronym for this eye for an eye strategy was ironically appropriate, MAD, which stood for Mutually Assured Destruction, if you weren't paying attention in history class. Needless to say, no one was very comfortable with this MAD idea. As the fictional launch control computer stated in the movie War Games, the only way to win was not to play. But then, winning was always a part of human nature. There had to be a way to win this game. Okay then, said the strategist in the Pentagon. Forget MAD. It's an awkward-sounding acronym anyway. Let's talk counterforce. Target the enemy's weapons. Of course, they had satellites too, and they would do the same to ours, at least until we all started putting our bombs aboard Orange Blossom specials. Okay. But maybe we could shoot their missiles down before they got to us, with ABMs or laser beams or death rays deployed on satellites in outer space. So the debates went on, new plans were made, the war gamers played their simulations. The missile crews went through their drills, and the high-stakes game of bluff poker went on with no one daring to lay down their cards. Until the day came when the clock finally ran out, and the game ran into sudden death. Sergeant Reese Tracy stood grabbing a quick smoke by his Jeep on the windswept plain outside Cheyenne. A few feet away from him was a fenced enclosure that contained one of the missile launch control facilities. It didn't look like much, only the dilapidated LCF building surrounded by sagebrush. It reminded him of a tumble-down building in a ghost town. In fact, it did have ghosts. Two missileers were buried here, 60 feet below the ground, sealed up as if inside a mausoleum. The details he was in charge of was in the process of trying to open up that mausoleum using heavy equipment. It was a slow, laborious process. Tracy nervously lit up another cigarette. It felt strange being out here. It gave him chills. There was a large area to the southeast that was still hot. They were uncomfortably close to it. Earlier in the day, they had examined a silo from which a Peacekeeper missile had been fired. The hatch had been popped open, thrown for a distance almost a quarter of a mile. Birds were nesting in the empty, dust-filled shaft, but there were still other silos from which the missiles hadn't been fired. And Tracy was a part of a unit that was taking inventory. He tried to imagine what it was like, people dying by the thousands, by the millions, dropping like flies that the virus had spread with devastating speed throughout the world, worse than any fallout. The missile crews had sat down in their launch control capsules, listening to radios or watching it on television. They would have heard the radio stations falling silent. They would have heard or seen the broadcasters dying on the air. The launch order had come down. The official line was that the Russians had launched first, but no one was really sure. At this point, it didn't really make much of a difference. The birds had flown, but most of them had never gotten off the ground. Otherwise, thought Tracy, there probably wouldn't be any ground for him to stand on. The world's suicide attempt had been a failed one. The planet had been badly wounded, but she had survived, just barely. And now? Tracy wasn't sure about what they were doing now. His unit had moved into Francis E. Warren about a month ago, coming up from Denver, to join the squadron led by General Zachary Cord. General Cord was the law in this part of the country, which was mostly large stretches of desolate no-man's land. The units he had brought together at the old Warren Air Force Base were among the finest fighting troops in the entire military. He had gathered together men from surviving units of the Delta Force and Rangers and incorporated them into his own special elite unit, Cobra Force. That name had been made legend by the Army's most famous living general. They were the elite of the elite, Growing up out of a small assault team that Cord was in command of in his younger days as a captain, a unit of the CIA's Special Operations Group. Their skill was such that they seemed almost supernatural, and all the other units in the military regarded them with awe. They wore distinctive uniforms, dark forest green trimmed with black, and their soldiers in black berets bore the Cobra Force patch, a black hooded snake with jaws agape over crossed yellow lightning bolts on a scarlet background. Their specialty was pacification. They were the most decorated soldiers of the old Special Operations Group. When the SOG had been officially disbanded, Cord, then a colonel, had been allowed to retain his own unit. He was given authority to expand the Cobra Force as a tactical troubleshooter force to take over the functions of the SOG, only this time under the command of the Army rather than the CIA, which had been relegated to a largely bureaucratic function. Since that time, the exploits of the Cobra Force had grown to almost mythic proportions. They had fought and defeated bands of savage raiders all across the country. They had stormed outlaw enclaves, fought renegade National Guard and police units. Their training program, organized by Cord himself, was rigorous enough to kill some of those who failed to measure up. And those who managed to make the grade knew that they were part of something very special indeed. And Cord made sure that they were treated special. They were like the Praetorians of Rome, the legendary immortals of ancient Persia, the ninjas of Japan. They answered to nobody but Cord. About the most a senior officer from any other unit could expect from them was a salute. Tracy was impressed by them, but they also made him nervous. Since moving into the old deserted base, Cord had put the other units under his command to work on refurbishment, reconstruction. The troops were quartered in brick barracks, and the senior officers lived in the old, colonial-style brick homes that dated back to the early days of the 20th century. Cord himself lived in an elegant brick mansion with a columned portico, wood floors, and a grand staircase with teak railings. A lifelong bachelor, Cord had surrounded himself with comfort. He had orderlies and servants to see to his every need, and he often threw elegant dinners for his men in the style of old frontier post commanders. He even held military balls. He had fought order back into this part of the country, and the town of Cheyenne had swelled with people moving in from outlying settlements. But Tracy had his doubts about what they were doing here. A lot of the missile silos throughout the country had been destroyed by Soviet strikes during the war, and many were located in hotspots that were still unsafe to enter. But there were still silos at Warren that were occupied by peacekeepers and a few leftover Minuteman missiles. The rail garrison plan, delayed time and again by various bureaucratic snafus, and only started to be implemented when the shit had hit the fan. Warner had only 3 missile trains standing in their garrisons, which was as far as the new deployment plan had come. And there were the underground LCCs, such as the one that they were engaged in opening, that had received the order to launch but had never been able to carry it out. Before they had sealed up, the airborne virus got to them and killed the launch crews, leaving the missiles standing in launch mode, like the world's biggest cocked and loaded guns. Tracy had first thought their purpose here was to deactivate those missiles, but they had opened up several silos so far, and they hadn't dismantled a single one. In fact, at these silos they had already opened, there were maintenance crews at work, checking out the systems and replacing components. There were crews at work upon the trains. For what? Assigned to every one of those crews, as to his own detail, were commandos of the Cobra Force. Scuttlebutt among those units recently arrived had Cord spending most of his time in the main launch control center, conferring with the civilian scientists sent out by the federal authorities from back east. Only, no one ever saw much of those scientists. No one ever spoke to them. They were quartered in one of the large brick mansions around the circular tree-lined drive where the senior officers lived, and that mansion was guarded around the clock by members of the Cobra Force. Sergeant Tracy had a horrible suspicion that their purpose here at Warren was not to deactivate those missiles at all, but to bring them back online. In fact, they had never gone offline. The question was, after all these years, were they still operational? Tracy's orders were to report precisely the condition of every silo that had opened up, especially the LCCs. How far had the crews inside gotten in their launch procedures before they had died? Had they opened up the red safe that contained their orders? Had they confirmed the launch codes? Had they accessed the firing mechanisms? Tracy was supposed to report everything they found down to the last detail. They were not to trust to touch anything. They were not to remove the bodies. They were simply to open up the silos and let the launch control capsules there and just observe in detail and report. Corporal Pat Summers came trotting up to his Jeep.
We got it open,
she said, slightly out of breath.
Want to see?
No,
said Tracy tightly.
Not really.
She grimaced.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Got a cigarette?
He passed her the pack. Most of the soldiers smoked. It was one of their few privileges. Cigarettes made from the tobacco grown in the southern agro communes were ludicrously expensive due to taxes. But soldiers got them cheap. It settled nerves and helped suppress the appetite, which was no small thing because of the chronic shortages.
I hate this part,
said Tracy.
Me too,
she said.
God, the first one we broke into, I was scared shitless. I know they told us the virus wouldn't still be active after all this time, but still, it doesn't seem to bother the Cobras, though.
Nothing bothers them,
said Tracy.
They're fucking machines.
They give me the creeps,
said Summers.
I've had several of them make passes at me. Corps doesn't allow women in Cobra Force, so they're all a bunch of horny motherfuckers. They can whack off or screw the townies for all I care. I wouldn't want to be caught alone with any of them. Snaky bastards.
She grinned at her unintentional pun.
Snaky cobras. That's a good one, huh?
Patty, what do you think about all this?
Asked Tracy. She gave him a sharp glance. They'd all been having the same thoughts, but so far none of them had spoken out loud.
Shit, Trace, I don't know,
she said.
It's all sort of spooky, ain't it?
You want to know what I think?
What I think? What?
She said with forced nonchalance.
I don't think our job here is to disarm any of those missiles,
he said.
I think it's all a smokescreen.
You too, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
I think Cord wants to get all those birds operational.
She was silent for a moment.
Why would he want to do that? You figure he knows something we don't?
Maybe. Nobody ever tells us anything. We have no need to know,
he added wryly.
We've still got missiles,
she said.
It stands to reason the Russians probably do too. You think maybe they've found out the Russians are trying to finish what they started?
Or maybe we are,
he replied.
I don't believe that.
Why not? Nobody really knows who pushed the button first.
Somebody's got to know.
Well, if they do, they're not telling us, that's for sure,
said Tracy.
Those civilian scientists are always kept under guard. Why?
It's for their own protection.
Against whom? Us?
Well, they're important personnel.
They're practically prisoners,
said Tracy.
I don't know anybody who's actually talked to any of them. Do you?
What are you saying?
Hell, I'm not sure what I'm saying,
he replied.
I only know that there's something weird going on. If we're not going to use those missiles, why aren't we dismantling them?
Well, for defense?
Against what?
Said Tracy.
A Soviet attack? You really believe that? We're probably in even worse shape than they are.
Well, we don't really know what's happening over there. They could be in a lot worse shape than we are. Or maybe...
Or maybe we want to make sure they are,
said Tracy.
Jesus, I don't like what I'm thinking, Pat. These things scare the shit out of me. We ought to be taking them apart. Instead, we've got maintenance crews in all the silos and the LCCs we've opened up. What the hell for? Haven't we learned anything, for God's sake?
She did not respond.
I don't know what the hell we're doing,
Tracy said.
Just like those two poor bastards down there didn't know what they were doing. A bunch of greasy terrorists released the goddamn plague, and we thought the Russians did it. They thought we did it, and between us, we almost blew up the fucking world. We ought to be melting them down into scrap metal, only we're not doing that. So what the hell are we doing?
You better lower your voice,
she said. Some of the people were coming out of the launch control facility.
Is it just me?
Tracy said.
Doesn't it bother you?
Yeah,
she said softly.
It bothers me. But what difference does that make? I don't see what we can do about it.
They can't be thinking of starting the whole thing up again,
said Tracy.
They just can't be. It's fucking insane.
One of the Cobras was beckoning to Tracy. Time to go down and make out this report.
Jesus!
Tracy threw down his cigarette butt.
What are we doing? What the hell are we doing?
Pat Summers followed him as he went through the gate and headed over to the LCF. The three Cobras were waiting for them.
You ready to go down, Sergeant, or are you still gold bricking?
One of them said.
All right, let's do it.
Tracy replied irritably. He had his clipboard out, ready to take notes on what they found. They went inside the LCF building. It was shaped like a rectangle, covered with tan-colored aluminum siding, with a garage. In the days before the war, the personnel who were assigned there here worked a three-day shift, living 3 days on the site, with 3 to 6 days off. From Warren, the closest LCF was about 35 miles to the north, and the farthest, known to the base personnel as Hotel, was about 150 miles to the east. The soldiers would drive out to the LCFs in Chevy or Dodge vans that would take the personnel coming off duty back to the base. The last shift was still here. As they went through the door, they entered a short entry hall with an open closet to the left. To the right was the flight security controller's office, to the nerve center of for the security police. It was walled off with a window looking in. The door of the small office had been busted in. There were two bodies inside, badly decomposed. One seated in a chair, the other sprawled out on the floor in front of the lockers. There were windows on three sides of the office, looking out at the barren expanse of the desert. Tracy noted the positions of the bodies and continued on into the building. They entered the large, carpeted main room that held couches, a color TV, chairs, and a pool table. There was a dining area and counters holding coffee makers, sugar, creamer, and various utensils. There was a Coke machine, magazines, a VCR, and shelves containing books and video cassettes. Tracy pulled one of the cassette tapes off the shelf and read the label. Apocalypse Now! He glanced at Pat. She compressed her lips and shook her head. The bodies of two security policemen were on the floor. Nothing left of them but bones. The kitchen was in the back, to the left, through a swinging door. It had a grill, a refrigerator, ovens, and a large freezer. They found what was left of the cook, sprawled on the floor in the front of the open refrigerator door. In the back were two bathrooms, one for men and one for women. The men's room was empty. The women's room had held one corpse, an SP. She was kneeling, draped over the toilet. She died in the act of throwing up blood. They found the rest of the bodies in the bunk rooms. There was a faded old rock and roll poster on the wall, bearing the legend, Metallica.
Hold my breath as I wish for death.
And depicting the grinning Death's head. Tracy swallowed hard and turned away.
Okay,
he said.
Let's go down into the hole.
He went back into the flight security controller's office. Behind the desk was a metal door with a window in the middle, and a wall phone beside it. A direct line down to the crew. The door had been forced open. They entered the elevator. Power had been restored to the facility by the diesel-fueled generators. They got into the elevator and started to descend. The elevator was an open wire cage. The walls of the shaft were bright yellow as they descended. When they got to the bottom, everything was gray. They stepped out into a little room. There was a heavy blast door directly in front of them, bearing the SAC emblem. To the right, in the recessed area, was a ladder and an access tube. There was a giant handle on the door, operated by a crank. It had been opened, giving access to the capsule junction. Through the door and to the left was the launch control equipment area, which held a brine chiller, the diesel generator, 1 month's supply of diesel fuel, air tubes with filters, part of the recycling system, and barrels with water and food for 30 days. The service had acronyms for everything. The MREs, meals ready to eat, were stored in green plastic packets with foil on the inside. They were to be mixed and boiled with water. Access to the LCC itself was on the right, through a concrete and steel door that weighed 3.5 tons. It was meant to be opened from the inside, breaking into it and taking most of the day. Once through it, they entered a square tunnel about 4 feet tall and 6 feet long. They crawled through it into the capsule. It was a dark acoustal enclosure painted gray. The Boeing computer racks were ancient, dating back to the 60s. It looked like a set from an old science fiction movie, all wires, vacuum tubes, and dials. When the cooling system was operating, the crews would have felt the air gushing around the racks. The computers had long since been overheated, but Tracy knew after he was finished here, the maintenance crews would start replacing them. Purely as a precaution, of course, to run checks on the systems and the missiles before it was dismantled. Sure, he thought. There was a small bed with a brown army blanket on it, a toilet, a sink, and a shower with a curtain for privacy. There was also a toaster oven, a small refrigerator that held cans of soda pop, a color television set, and one of the missileers had brought down a portable radio, what they used to call a boom box. There were several tape cassettes behind it. Tracy punched the eject button and removed the cassette from the tape deck. Guns N' Roses. The cassette was titled Appetite for Destruction. Corpses of the two missileers were strapped into their chairs. Skeletons in blue uniforms with yellow scarves around their necks. By the scraggly remains of hair, they could tell that both were women. Tracy tried not to look at their name tags. He didn't want to know their names. They had opened up the safe and removed their orders and their keys. Both keys had been inserted and turned, allowing access to the firing mechanisms. And then they died, both with their heads back, jaws agape, and in never-ending silent screams. One of them had propped a photograph on the console before her. Tracy picked it up. It showed two people in late middle age, a man and a woman, both smiling with their arms around each other. The inscription read, "Make us proud, honey. Love, Mom and Dad."
"Come on, Sergeant! Get a move on!"
one of the Cobras said.
"We haven't got all day!"
"Yeah, sure,"
said Tracy. He bit his lower lip and started making out his report. As she went down the hall to the elevator banks, Raven Scarpetti was followed closely by three security guards who watched her walk appreciatively. They undressed her with their eyes. It didn't bother her. She was used to that kind of reaction from most men, and the way she walked tended to provoke it. Women who deliberately tried to walk in a sexually provocative manner often weren't able to pull it off without making it look exaggerated and artificial, because it was not their natural way of walking. But hookers were experts at it, largely because it became natural for them. They did it without thinking, and Raven didn't bother trying to change the way she walked simply because she was no longer turning tricks. She didn't bother trying to change the way she talked or the way she dressed either. She wasn't particularly proud of her former occupation, far from it. But it was part of who she was, and she wasn't about to erase that aspect of her life. It had happened, and she was not going to deny it. She had been a teenage girl when her crime boss boyfriend had dumped her on a sadistic pimp who brutalized her, and she had grown up in the life. It had forged her, hardened her, and given her instincts for survival. It had served her well. She wore her past life as a badge of defiance, as if to say, "That's right, I was a hooker! Want to make something of it?" It was like a veteran's battle scar. She wouldn't think of trying to remove it. It was something she had fought and lived through. And if her man could accept her as she was, that was good enough for her, and anybody else could go to hell. The door slid shut and the elevator started to descend. She felt the guard's eyes on her. Her breasts were on the small side. Some men had a tendency to focus on her long and well-shaped legs. She knew they were She knew they were outstanding legs, her best feature, aside from her face, which made her look younger than she really was. In her early 20s, she looked not a day over 18. She was pretty, but that prettiness was touched with feral hardness, a trashy combination few men could resist. She caught them staring at her legs, and they quickly looked away.
"Like what you see?"
she asked. The guards exchanged glances, and one of them cleared his throat. "Sorry, ma'am. Didn't mean to stare."
"Bullshit."
The man grimaced uncomfortably. "Yes, ma'am." She smiled. The elevator stopped in the basement and they transferred to another one that took them down to the maximum security levels. It descended to B3. The doors opened on what looked like a concrete bunker. Two helmeted soldiers in combat fatigues, armed with automatic weapons, stood before them. They left the elevator and turned down a short corridor that led to a security post. Beside it, behind a gate, was a massive barred steel door. There were two other soldiers stationed on either side of it, and another behind a console. "Mrs. Raven Scarpetti to see Lieutenant Steele," said one of the guards. "Morning, ma'am," said the guard behind the console. He checked her pass. "Thank you, ma'am. Step through the gate, please." She went through the gate, which scanned her as she passed through it. It didn't pick up any weapons. She had left the snub-nosed 38 Smith & Wesson air weight she kept in her purse at the security post up in the lobby. The man at the console spoke into his mic to another security post behind the heavy door. It was opened electronically from inside. They passed through and went down a corridor that ended at the entrance to the project lab. Another two soldiers were posted at the doors. Entering the lab complex, they made their way past banks of electronic computer equipment, computers, desk terminals, and office cubicles manned by busy personnel, and passed through another door at the back of the complex. This door opened to a short, carpeted corridor. There were several doors leading into rooms on either side. They stopped at the third one on their left, and one of the guards knocked.
"Come in,"
said a voice from inside. The guard opened the door and stood aside to let Raven enter. Inside, it was about the size of an average hotel room, and it looked like an average hotel room, too. The only real difference was the lack of windows. There was dark carpet on the floor, the better to conceal stains, a queen-size bed, a reading chair with a standing lamp beside it, a round table with two straight-backed chairs pushed up to it, a bureau opposite the bed with a television set on top of it, a small sound system, a bathroom to the left of the entryway, and a walk-in closet. There were several nondescript prints hanging on the wall, a lamp on the bureau beside the television, and two light fixtures bolted to this wall on either side of the bed, above the nightstands. It was reasonably comfortable, but hardly homey. Donovan Steele stretched out on the bed, dressed only in a robe, reading a book. An old science fiction novel by William Gibson. He looked up, smiled, and put the book down on the bed as Raven came in and shut the door behind her. There was a stack of novels piled on the nightstand to his right.
So,
she said.
Read any good books lately?
Not many, but this one's not half bad, said Steele. This guy was writing about people wired up and interfacing with computers long before they ever came up with the biochip. They called it cyberpunk, according to the jacket copy.
Cyberpunk?
She said.
Yeah. Chips and drugs and rock and roll. Strong stuff. It's been interesting how close he came in some ways. Must have been a strange young man.
She sat down beside him on the bed and glanced at the author's photo on the jacket on the book jacket.
Looks like a hip undertaker,
she said.
Kind of cute, though.
And here I thought you went for the macho type, he said.
Nah, they're a pain in the ass. Like you.
She took his hand.
I miss you, lover.
I miss you, too.
She leaned forward and kissed him. He put his arms around her, nice steel arms covered with polymer skin, arms that could so easily crush her. They held the kiss for a long time, her tongue slipping into his mouth, eagerly seeking his, her hands entwined in his dark hair. He slipped his hand under her dress. She wasn't wearing panties. He caressed her softly, knowing that to her it felt like a perfectly normal human hand, but to him it wasn't quite the same. On close examination, it looked like an ordinary hand of flesh and blood, but there was a small indentation in the palm, sheathed with polymer skin. It resembled a scar, except that it was perfectly round like a quarter. Initially, it had been a gun port for a sophisticated dart launcher built into his left forearm, but since his last trip to the body shop, as he referred to it, his systems had been upgraded. The entire left arm, which had sustained damage in his fight with Stalker, had been removed and replaced with a much more sophisticated prosthesis that now contained a built-in carbon dioxide laser slave to his cybernetic brain. It was more than a little unsettling for him to think that he was caressing her with such an awesome weapon. But it was more than that. It was a part of him, as much as his flesh and blood parts were. And with the laser tube retracted to his forearm, there was no danger to her. The tiny sensors in his polymer skin transmitted information to his cybernetic brain, where it was translated into feeling, a sense of touch that could either be normal or far more acute than normal, depending on how much he adjusted the sensitivity. As he touched her, he turned his sensors all the way up, and his mind filled with the warmth and softness of her. If an ordinary man could have experienced such intensity of feeling, it would have been more than enough to make him climax on the spot. But Steele was not an ordinary man. His cybernetic brain gave him complete control of his organic functions that any ordinary gave him more complete control of his organic functions than any ordinary man could possibly achieve. As he made love to her with that part of him that was still flesh and blood, the sensors built into his nice steel prosthetics flooded him with the taut and silky feel of her, and his computer brain allowed him to exert a measure of control that ordinary men could only dream of. 3.5 hours later, Raven lay beside him, filmed with a sheen of sweat, her short black hair hanging down into her eyes as she gently stroked his chest.
God, no one ever loved me the way you do,
she murmured dreamily.
Yeah, cyborgs make the ultimate sex toys.
She grimaced.
Don't. It isn't just the sex, and you know it. Don't get me wrong. The sex is incredible, but there's a lot more to it than that. I've had my share of studs, but none of them have ever made me feel as wanted as you do.
She sighed.
I wish to hell you'd lighten up and stop laying all these guilt trips on yourself. If I can accept you the way you are, why can't you?
Maybe I just don't accept things as easily as you do, he said. Don't get me wrong. That's not a criticism. I envy you for it.
You think I'd love you any less the way you were before?
It isn't that, he said. It's like I told you. It isn't you. It's me.
What is it, Steele? How can I help?
I don't know if you can.
He stared up at the ceiling.
Just now, when we were making love, I had this brief flash. Like a fragment of a memory.
What was it?
He sighed and looked at her.
It's probably not the most flattering of things to say, but while we were making love for a moment, just an instant, I had this fleeting image of someone else. But I don't know who she was. I have these gaps. I can't account for them.
Was she blonde and very beautiful?
Said Raven after a moment's hesitation. He frowned.
Yes! How did you know?
She sighed. Or, as it says, she signed.
It was Drek's wife.
He stared at her.
My ex-wife? I was married?
She nodded.
Jesus, I don't even remember.
They said I shouldn't talk about it. They've probably got the room bugged, but fuck it, I don't care. What they did was wrong. It stinks, and I'm not going to be a part of it.
What are you talking about?
They told you that you're being kept here until they can make sure all the new upgrades work properly.
She said.
But there's more to it than that. They modified your engram matrix. They went in and erased some things. That's why you have those gaps. It isn't because there's anything wrong with you. They did it. Higgins and that Dr. Stone.
Tell me,
he said, frowning.
You were married for almost 20 years.
20 years?
Her name was Janice. I met her once after she divorced you. She was about your age, very beautiful and very classy. But she wasn't very nice.
Raven grimaced.
Well, that's probably not fair. I guess I'm prejudiced. She hurt you. I didn't like her very much, and she sure as hell didn't like me. She looked at me like I was trash. And I guess from her point of view, I am.
I can't remember anything about her,
Steele said, stunned.
Just that fleeting image of her face. Were there any children?
You had two kids, your son Jason and your daughter, Corey.
Jesus Christ!
You don't remember any of this, do you?
He shook his head with disbelief.
From what you told me, your marriage was pretty rocky for a long time. After you were shot and they put you back together as a cyborg, your wife divorced you because she couldn't handle it.
The door suddenly flew open and three security guards burst in. I'm sorry, Miss Scarpetti. You're going to have to leave. Right now.
She's not going anywhere,
said Steele, sitting up in the bed. There was a hard edge to his voice. Get the hell out of here! I'm sorry, Lieutenant. We can't do that, said the guard. Please, this isn't even personal, sir. I don't like doing this, but we've got our orders. Steele's eyes suddenly started to glow. The pupils became brightly illuminated with red light as his laser designator system switched in. He had no intention of shooting at these men, but his eyes had a tendency to light up whenever he got angry. It had a very unsettling effect on people. It had that effect on the guards.
Get out!
He said. Please, sir, don't make this difficult for us.
If you intend to take her out of here, you'll have to go through me!
He said.
That won't be necessary,
said Jennifer Stone from behind the guards. She came into the room.
Please excuse this intrusion. We'll give you some time to get dressed. Then I'll come back in and we can discuss this reasonably.
She's not leaving,
Steele said.
As you wish. Gentlemen, let's give these people some privacy.
They left and closed the door behind them.
I'd better get dressed,
said Raven, getting out of bed.
I shouldn't have said anything. I should have waited till you'd been released.
So that's why I've been kept here, Steele said. They did a little washing on my brain, and they wanted to see if it would take.
I should have kept my mouth shut,
she said.
I guess I've really screwed things up.
I'm glad you told me.
Steele got up and went over to the closet. He started putting on his clothes.
I'm getting out of here.
They may not want you to leave yet.
Then they're going to have to stop me, Steele said. But one thing's for sure. I'm not leaving until I get some answers.
End of chapter.